great white hunter return to lowlands, bring trophy. One rabbit. The hunting was magnificent. It was really great. The hunting was terrific. We had a great hunt. We just didn't have a very good find. We didn't find anything, but we did have a good hunt. It was good to get away and get up there to the high mountains again, be surrounded by many, many other men running around, armed with lethal weapons, wearing red. You could hunt for hours in what you thought was abandoned and deserted landscape that probably had not known the tread of human souls from the time of Columbus. Round a tree, and there was a hunter sitting on a rock wondering what you were doing hunting on private land when you had just crossed the fence that said National Forest. It was a little confusing, to say the least, where we hunted. We went into brand new country and did have a real wonderful time from the standpoint of camping. Some dear friends, yeah, who cares? Jim Thornhill, Bill Evans came up all the way from Southern California, and we had Eric Williams and Wayne Freeman up there with us, and Mr. Carnes, of course, was there, and Larry Watkins and I drove up together in my truck, and we did have a marvelous time. It was good to get away, but it's also very good to get back. So here we are again. Next time, I think we'll probably try the drawings where they have a kind of a lottery, or they draw names out of a hat, or however they do it. If you apply to the state game many, many months in advance for either bow hunting or black powder or special seasons, or else you have to get on private land. But going up and competing with tens of thousands of Texans and Californians, and it's like a regular invasion in the state of Colorado in the hunting season this time of the year, and competing with that massive number of people on public land is very, very difficult indeed to try to really get any kind of game and bring it back. But I was blessed with a deer last year and two antelope this year, so I really can't complain. I got a good amount of game in the freezer as it is, and we'll be eating on that for quite some time to come. Well, as you know, just after the feast, we went down to San Jose, and we had just a one-day campaign down there. I think you probably heard about it. It wasn't magnificent, but it was satisfactory. We had about 197 people, and we had the experience of going to dinner with Mr. and Mrs. John Garnett. And then right at the end of the dinner that evening before, she was feeling a little bit unusual. She was obviously right far along in, an advanced stage of expectancy. And so the very next day, right during the campaign, a new little Garnett, I don't know what his name is yet, but it was a boy, was born. And had they been there, we would have had exactly 300. But as it was, father, mother, and newborn were all in the hospital at that time. So here John had been one of the couple or three that had been ramrodding the campaign and running about and arranging TV spots and newspaper ads and handing out placards all over town and really trying to be the organizer for it, and then he had to miss it. But I think for an event like that, he was willing to do so. Well, I've got, I hope, what is some really great good news for us. Mr. Sharp told me this morning that we have contracted, and we will begin 1 week from Sunday, 1 week from tomorrow, on a TV station you will be able to view, for a change, in Shreveport, Channel 3, at 9 a.m. every Sunday morning. We've signed a 26-week contract. We haven't signed it yet. We've taken it verbally, and we'll sign it shortly. So remember, Channel 3, Shreveport, 1 week from tomorrow, we're beginning. Shreveport is the 50th market in the United States. It will reach approximately a third of a million or more households in many, many towns and cities all around the area. And what we're going to do is to have a kind of a news blitz. We will type up and release a news release to newspapers in Big Sandy, Gilmer, Gladewater, Longview, Lufkin, Bossier City, Shreveport, and all around as a news release of returning to television in the area, and hope that that'll be free publicity. Then secondly, we will design an ad, and where we can afford it, even in some of the smaller papers, and some of the reporters know me, and I'm sure they will be glad, such as Jimmy Brown up at Gladewater, to write a little article on it, and try to get people aware of the fact that we will be on. Radio spots also are a possibility. I was thinking of KWKH in Shreveport for, say, a 30-second radio spot to announce sometime for approximately a week in advance that we will be on. And, of course, television spots in the first week or two of the program. So tell everybody that you think of in the general public, all your friends, make some phone calls, whatever you can do to help make sure the people know that we're going to be on over there a week from Sunday. Unfortunately, I missed the meeting just last week where the revised building plans were gone over once again. And I understand there is to be another meeting this next week at some time when the prospective builder will come back. There's some little things to iron out about just the way the restrooms and the public meeting facility will be. And of course, as you know, we're constrained by two definite parameters, one of which is cash flow, and the second of which is, of course, the required number of square feet. And those two have to fit exactly together, and that determines the size, the quality, and whether or not we can go ahead with the building. I think it's going to be possible by scaling down some of the offices, by cutting out one or two that we might not really need, and by just fitting everything in nice and snugly to go ahead and have an adequate meeting room. It won't be as big as this room, but with a different seating arrangement, it should be certainly very comfortable. And to be in our own facility will be marvelous. Hopefully, we can arrange it in such a way that one of the larger offices might even open up with a temporary door, and we could provide an additional room like that for our Sabbath school that would double as a boardroom. We just don't know, but we'll be working on those things with the builder. Then 1 week from next Thursday, I think it is, my son Mark and I and one other young man that I haven't met yet from Dallas, who is a professional TV cameraman, at the invitation and at the expense of the royal family of Jordan, will be departing Dallas for New York and there on over to Amman, Jordan, and to be there for about 4 or 5 days and conducting interviews, try to bring back a few hundred feet of television tape as well as radio on-the-spot broadcasts, and hopefully get some articles from over there, some pictures, and so on. As you know, King Hussein has been in the United States for the past few days and unfortunately announced that for the first time in all these many years that Jordan has been a friend of the United States and has been almost exclusively shopping in the United States and in France for their military hardware, Jordan has turned around and bought surface-to-air missiles, SAMs, and SAM sites are going to be installed by Russian technologists in the nation of Jordan. Now, of course, that's bad news for Israel because surface-to-air is a technical term, but they can also be pointed down and triggered to fly over and land on territory that belongs to the enemy if it's necessary. Of course, Hussein and the Jordanians are against the Camp David Accord. They are crying loudly for the return of their own captured lands, which includes East Jerusalem and all of the West Bank, and are a nation which, while they have crossed swords with Syria because of the Palestinians up there in southern Syria, on the other hand, they nevertheless are very staunchly anti-Israel and pro-Arab and would like to see a separate Palestinian state with a headquarters in Jerusalem. That's not going to happen. So it'll be interesting to talk to him, especially in the wake of what's happened in Egypt, and we'll hope that we can bring back some good programs on Bible prophecy and in the Middle East. When I go hunting, when I have an opportunity to get in the out-of-doors again, it always gives me a chance to do some thinking and contemplating and recharging of batteries. And in thinking about some of the aspects of human life, of the incredible amount of work we go to perpetuate, to protect, to preserve, to feed, to clothe, to comfort ourselves, to ensure that we are at all times comfortable with regard to temperature, we're neither too cold nor too warm, that we are comfortable with regard to the amount of food or water or liquids in our stomachs, that we're comfortable in our position where we are seated or where we're lying down. And you begin to get back to these basics of food, clothing, and shelter when you're camping out. If you pitch your tent in an area with some snow and you determine a little later on that that reason your back is aching is because there's a knot that was concealed underneath a light covering of pine needles right in the middle of your sleeping bag, it makes it real miserable. And you really pay a lot of attention to making yourself comfortable. Maybe you enjoy wildlife like I do. Maybe you've seen otters. And you've watched the way they capture fish or the way they'll even take a carrot if you see one in a zoo and how fastidious they are. The tremendous amount of work they will go to, just like many other creatures like your coons that inhabit this part of the country, at scrubbing and busily cleaning. Well, you can watch little squirrels doing that up in the mountains and you can see how much attention they pay to themselves. I was hunting elk with Larry, and I drove down a little old muddy road and over a rim and down into an open valley, and there in the distance was a little pond. And as far as I could see, it was completely stripped of vegetation. But up in a little kind of a draw was a stand of quakies or of aspen. Only a few of them left now. Most of them are gone. And leading up to that stand of aspen was a huge, big, muddy trough filled with water, and about two-thirds up, the water quit because that was the level of this big cattle pond. It was very muddy. And then for the rest of the distance was just this big, black, muddy trail, just slick as it could be, not a blade of grass, no sticks, nothing in it, very clear. And up in the quaking aspen grove were just stumps like so many broken toothpicks, all very neatly done. But unfortunately, that was a cattle pond, and it was fenced. And here in the middle of it, on one side, was a huge beaver house, higher than my head, and lying all in front of it were dozens of freshly cut aspen branches. Now, you know the beaver eat aspen or quakey bark. And what they do is cut it up with their teeth into various little neatly stacked portions that they can actually take down underneath, and they get up in, they build several different, they have a feeding segment in there, and they have a sleeping one, and this and that. And they kind of hibernate, not totally. They'll wake up in the middle of winter, crawl in the other, in the kitchen in there, you know, and take a section of aspen and begin to gnaw on it and eat it, and then go back and curl up and go to sleep, and they will hibernate for the winter. Well, this little guy was swimming in the pond when I drove over the rise, and as I drove down and parked, he saw me and, of course, disappeared underneath. Well, I ran to the edge because I knew he was going to come up and take a peek, see where I was. And when I got down to the edge, he came up, and I could see the little eyes and the wet whiskers and saw me, and poof, right back down again. And he didn't come up this time until he was right at the entry to his beaver house. And he looked up at me and then immediately dove under the water, and he was gone, and underneath this huge beaver house. Well, this little guy was eating himself out of his territory. And what was fascinating was that there was a fence under which this little trough, this little chute that he used to go up, cut the tree up in lengths, grab a hold of one of the branches, and waddle down, dragging it down this little trough, getting into the water, and then, of course, swimming along and carrying it over and depositing it where he wanted for his food. Now, obviously, the lower strand of wire was in his way, and some of the branches must have kept hanging up as he would pull it and tug it and pull it. It wouldn't go anywhere. So here was this big, thick cedar post hanging by two strands with two, just like it had been put in a pencil sharpener, chewed right in two, just lying there. It must have been very frustrating to the beaver because he had chewed the fence post in two, but the wire was still there. And he was having a terrible time doing it. Well, as I contemplate creatures like that, I look at the birds running around and gathering food for the winter that was coming on. I hear the ranchers talk about how unusual it is to see the deer leave their property so early. I hear other hunters and ranchers saying that all the elk and all the deer seem to be way down low. And I see the squirrels running around really seeming to be very, very frantic and very busy. These little creatures were telling the ranchers, and they told us, it's going to be a hard winter up there. And somehow they know that. They know it in advance. But what triggers it? And how do they know it? And you ponder that for a while, and you try to figure out, what instinct is it that because of changing pressures and therefore changing weather patterns, early snows and so on, can dictate to little animals who depend upon such things as quaking aspen bark or little chinkypin nuts or little nuts out of pine cones for their winter's food, who hibernate to work doubly fast and very, very hard and sometimes work much earlier than normal to store enough food to last out a winter. And if man couldn't observe the animals, man would have no way of knowing. The animals are actually predicting the weather months in advance. I've always been interested, as I think all of us are to some degree or another, in nature, in such things as the origin of life, the structure of our human anatomical, physical beings, our circulatory, nervous, skeletal, muscular, digestive systems. I've been interested in the macrocosm of space and the microcosm of microbacterial action, and the system of our digestion that causes a symbiosis and also a symbiotic relationship between little tiny creatures, millions, myriads of them that inhabit our intestines, our trachea, that are in our nose, in our ears, and that are in on our skin, and that actually help us as a metabolic organism to digest our food, and without them we couldn't even live. As I look at water, at trees, at lichens, at rocks, at growing herbs, at living creatures and animals, it forces me to contemplate, how did it all begin, about the mind of God that created it all and set it in motion and that continues to sustain it and let it operate the way it does, and what we are and really why we walk around on the earth and spend our lives, too many people in the big cities, certainly in the big nations of our country, in boredom, just going to work, doing some obnoxious job they really wish they didn't have to do, and then just waiting to die. Now, when you take the proverbial person who lives in a factory, and all over up in there you would see people who used to live in a way that I could never fathom, could never do at all. But people who, let's say, mine coal in Pennsylvania, who work on an assembly line in the GM plant in Ypsilanti, or who perhaps were hard rock miners up around Silverton in Colorado. Here you are coming over a divide about 11,000 feet up, 10,900 feet up. And way above you, on some of the most precipitous, when I say steep, you're tempted to say it's as steep as that brick wall because it almost looks that way. It looks like it's close to 90 degrees, but it certainly is about 65 degrees in some cases. And even a 45 degree slope is very, very steep. And here will be these mine tailings, just these telltale, great, huge, yellowish sometimes, detritus, rubble, and so on. And you will look very carefully, you see a little remnants of an old bunch of metal and maybe wood, and that was the mine shaft, and maybe where they crawled up there with one burrow or whatever, and that way, way back, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of men were laboring and toiling way deep back in those mountains, grubbing around, getting rock out of there, bringing it out, pulverizing it, and both through heat and chemical action and so on, trying to extract gold and silver to what? Well, to make a living. Or, hopefully, even to get rich, so they don't have to work anymore. Now, when I think of generations of miners around Leeds and Manchester and some of the middle section of England and the eastern part of the United States, of men and women who had devoted their lives to doing nothing more than putting food in this end, keeping the other end nice and open, if you believe the television ads about all the people who have problems in that direction, sleeping well at night, enjoying the experience of life and yet going through some of the most obnoxious methods of maintaining that life that you can imagine, and you just have to ask, what's it all about? If you go past a senior citizen's village or you see up there in the mountains where many people are moving to retire, hundreds and hundreds of trailer houses, and here are people who cannot afford a home, who worked and slaved all their lives, who were in their late middle age or early old age, living in a trailer house and waiting to die. Now, I live in a retirement kind of a village out in Emerald Bay. The majority of people out there are well over 50. Probably an average would be about 63 to 65. They do one or two things all week long. They play golf and they party. Now, when they party, they go to different homes, they go to the clubhouse, and it's all scheduled. We get a schedule every week in the mail. And every Saturday morning, the Emerald Bay Men's Golfing Association has a breakfast, exchanges stories. They've heard them all by now, and they're trying to dredge up new ones, and then go out and hit the golf course until noon. Every Sunday morning, they're all in the church, and a certain group beat the guys that go to church and get on the golf course early. Every Friday afternoon, the men and the women team up, and they have what is called a scramble, where six or eight people, mixed couples, get out, they hit the ball. The best ball of the group is where they all take their ball, pick it up, put it down, and hit it, and everybody comes in with 5 or 6 under par. Every Sunday evening, they play bingo. On Wednesday, the menu is nearly always stew. On Tuesday, it's a buffet. On Thursday, it is steak. And on Monday, the club is closed. Their lives are very regulated. There is never any question in their minds from week to week exactly what they're going to be doing, especially in the summer when they can expect to get out on the golf course. And I look around at these people going by out there, and I think, I wonder how many of them know what it's all about, why they have lived this life, and why those pictures of the kids and the grandkids are on the piano or the mantle, and what it was all about. One old gentleman, one time we were out there for dinner, the Darts and some others were there, and he came up and kind of cheerful. I said, "Hi, Emmett, how you doing?" I hadn't seen him for a while. He said, "Well, not so good, Ted." He said, "I lost my wife a couple of weeks ago, and I felt real badly about that. I really did." And I said, "Oh, I'm sorry to hear that, Emmett." And talked to him a while and tried to encourage him, but, you know, he just tears here and there and is all shaken up. Here he is. He's probably, in his late 70s. And now he's alone and no one else around. And that club and that life out there is all that he's really got to look forward to. I know nothing about his background, what he's accomplished, or what he's been. We have a retired Air Force general out there. I don't think anybody that was under him or around him or used to watch him fly in World War II when he was a fighter pilot, remembers much about it now. All of his medals are tarnished and old and folded up and put away in a drawer. Everybody just calls him John. When he rides around in the front yard on his little mower, he looks just like any other old farmer out there mowing the grass. I don't know what more he's got to look forward to. The past glories are all gone. A few people show him some respect, but nobody salutes him anymore. The good days have long since passed away. His wife sells real estate when she can, once in a great while. Now, as I ponder life, and I look at the fact that I myself am on the wrong side, as they say, of the half-century mark, and life goes along, and when I go walking up the mountains these days, I seem to breathe a little harder than I did last year. And I breathed a little harder last year than I did the year before. When I was 46, I was in great shape. When I was 36, I was competing with 18 and 19-year-olds on a basketball court and doing rather well. Now that I'm 51, slowed down just a little bit. Begin to look signs of age here and there. Got up this morning, wandered in to say hello to my wife. She almost fled. I hadn't shaved yet. I had about 8 days here. My hair was going straight up, about four circles each. And she told me I looked like a mountain man. I told her I looked like an old something or other. And I did. I really did. I looked bad when I got up this morning. So I got in there and shaved and tried to look a little bit better than I had before. Well, when I contemplate about life, I'm no different than what it says in the second chapter of the book of Hebrews, beginning in about verse 5, when we contemplate about life and humanity and human nature and why we are and what we are. In verse 5 of Hebrews 2, "For unto the angels has he not put in subjection the age to come," which is what we are talking about, says Paul, to put it in the vernacular. "God has not made the universe and the earth for the angels to inhabit. He has made the universe and the earth for us to inhabit. But one in a certain place testified, saying, What is man?" Now, you know, David was the one who asked that question, and David was a student of nature. And in the many, many hours that he must have spent with Solomon, when Solomon was a baby boy and was growing up, David somehow managed to put so much of that awe, that admiration of life, of wild creatures, of sea creatures, of living things, of herbs, of trees, of the seasons, the stars, the universe, in the mind of Solomon. That Solomon, too, if you read Ecclesiastes and you read the Proverbs, was quite a student of nature. And you will find more about nature, about conies and eagles and lions and creatures of the land, about the human body, about birth, and statements of praise and exaltation toward God as a man observes these things. You'll find more of that in the Psalms and a great deal of it in Ecclesiastes and in the Proverbs than any other part of the Bible. I pointed out to you in a sermon some weeks ago, maybe a couple of months ago, that almost always when the apostles of God, and Paul did this to the Areopagites, when the prophets of God who came before kings, and even when God himself, who wanted to show his glory to Job, wanted to reveal things about God, they turned to nature. They turned to life, to the seasons, to great creatures in the sea, to even such little creatures as ants, as Solomon said, "Consider the ant, thou sluggard," and to birds, to conies, or to rockchucks, in other words, to the marmots in the mountains, and looked at the creation, at that which is made. Now, the highest thing that we can know that is made is us. We have identified the highest thing around, and he is us. There's no doubt in our minds, most of us, that we are the best thing around. That's one of our problems, oftentimes. So when David asked, "What is man, that thou art mindful of him? Or the son of man, that you visit him or pay any attention to him? You have made him a little lower than the angels." Now, that's a fantastic statement. I have never seen an angel. I've seen people in whom I think there were fallen angels. I've never heard an angel's voice, but I've heard human voices being used by fallen and rebellious angels. But I've never seen a righteous angel. I don't really think I want to, because those accounts that I find in the Old Testament of the Bible where people saw in vision or suddenly face to face an angel who manifested himself, it scared them so bad that they became just petrified. They lost their breath and their senses and were just astonied, as it says in the Bible. But when you stop to think, the fact that man has been able to subdue Not only animals and creatures. If you wanted to go, I think right now in Dallas, the Shriners Circus is playing, isn't it? And we were talking this morning a little bit about some of the programs in the past that he called some of the best mail, the very tightly structured programs we've done on TV about ants or bees or birds or migratory waterfowl or dolphins and the toothed whales. And even on the Johnny Carson show, some comedian will come along after Joan Embry has been there with some of the little creatures from the San Diego Zoo. And one of the cutest ones we ever saw was a little marmoset or whatever he was that jumped up on top of Johnny's head. And it was one of the funniest things. It was just delightful. You could look at this little critter. He's a little monkey, and he's only about this tall. And he's looking around, and it was just like a little tiny human being. He expected the thing to talk. And he had a little problem right on top of Johnny's head. And Johnny was, the expression on his face is, you'll see it, because if you watch one of his annual shows, they'll show that over and over again. And so old hoofers and old vaudeville performers and old-timers all the way from the Bob Hopes to the most famous man in comedy will tell you it's an old hack, an old saw, it's axiomatic that you don't follow animals or children on the stage or on television, because there's something in all of us that when we're flipping around the dial and we're seeing the tube changing and we see a beautiful elk walking along in a stream, or we see a bear, or we see some fish swimming, we're stopping and we're going to watch that. Because all of us, whether we like it or not, some of us are naturalists and some of us study it and read it and get excited about it, and others, ho-hum, we couldn't care less. But we're attracted to animals and creatures, to the creation that is around us. We're interested in looking at them. Now, when you look at the marvelous mind of man, at what man has been able to do, I could tell you for the next few minutes, but it would be boring, about an inertial navigation system. But let's just think about the world that we're on for a moment and ask ourselves, who made the weekly cycle? Now, think about that for a minute. Where did the weekly cycle come from, and by what method of observation can you tell which day it is? Well, you can't. I can just make it short and sweet for you. There's no way. It is only by the preservation of that knowledge from the time of the revelation of that knowledge to one human being, then to the family of man, to the descendants of Noah, and to ancient Israel from Almighty God, that man has kept track, particularly one race to whom was given the oracles of God, the Jews, has kept track of the weekly cycle. Now, how can you know where north is in the daytime? Does anybody know? Some of you here can tell me. Yes, you know how? That's one way, but there's a way using a watch. What about the method of finding out where north is at night? Even some of you ladies can tell me that. You know how to find out north at night? Yeah. The Big Dipper, and where do you look for on the Big Dipper? The two stars, right, that form the part of the dipper from which you would pour the water, and you draw a line from then, and you see a star up there. Now, if you look very carefully, that star is the tail of the Little Dipper, and the tail of the Little Dipper is the North Star. Now, you can go out, and the Big Dipper's over here, and then after a while, way early in the morning, it's over there upside down, and it is revolving around. But the only star in the Northern Hemisphere that doesn't move at all, it's like the little pinwheel, it's like the axle in the middle of all the stars, is the North Star. It's always in the same position. No matter where the dippers go, the North Star. Now, how come? I was up in camp, and I took out one of my compasses was malfunctioning, and I had to throw it away. The other one was working great. I had three, so I had to double bag up. Took out my compass. A little needle quivered. Pretty soon it settled down, and that was north. Now, what in the world was it pointing to? Well, it was pointing to what is called magnetic north, and that's different from what they call true north, which is off just a little bit. Now, who invented that? What causes that little needle that is magnetized and covered with sulfur so I can see it at night, phosphorescent so it'll glow in the dark, to swing around and to point faithfully toward the north? If you had one in your pocket right now, you could pull it out, get it away from a lot of metal, a lot of heavy chains, or a big metal belt buckle, hold it out there, and it will point to north. What is north, and why is north? What if the world were just perfectly round, which it isn't quite, but it didn't have any poles or polar ice caps. It was all a nice subtropical Mediterranean or whatever type of climate. But there were no hump or bulge, no pile of rocks, no stick stuck in the ground, no big gnarled tree, no particular mountain to which all the nations and all the races of mankind to relate and say, that is north. And how would they have done so anyway? Nations can't agree, can't get along. When you go back through history of the ancient races, from the pyramid builders of the Yucatan Peninsula to the ancient Egyptians and clear back to the Sumerians and Babylonians and the people who built Akkad and Calneh and those under Nimrod who built ancient Babylon, how would they have determined which is up and which is down? When you open up a map, you always hold a map which way? You never hold it south or east. You always hold north is at the top, isn't it? North is at the top. Well, how did it get to be north? Why isn't it some other direction? Somewhere, somehow, somebody or something determined in making the world and putting this smallest of all the planets, the most inferior, tiny little body in space, nearly, with its one little moon, in a particular, peculiar place, exactly the right distance, within only a mile or so of the sun, the moon exactly the right distance, within a few hundred yards or so of the Earth, and then set about to put into this Earth environment of ours, this Eretz, that structure of symbiotic relationship from the microcosmic life of bacteria to the macrocosm of the universe to make a beautiful, harmonious environment for us. For some cantankerous old coot who has lived his life in the coal mines of Pennsylvania, is living now in his trailer house at age 65 with all of his teeth gone, who is opinionated and prejudiced, a regular Archie Bunker who hates blacks and Jews and is waiting to die and doesn't even know what his life was all about. And while he was grubbing down there in a wealth of buried fossil life, it never even occurred to him or to hundreds of thousands like him to ask, how did that coal get down there? And what was that life like when it rained on the earth in the age of fish and dinosaurs? But to these men of the Bible, David, Solomon, men of God, even such as the Apostle Paul, who said that we understand those things about the divine God by looking at the things that he made, by looking at those things that his hand has produced. To these men, they asked the questions that the average human being, my neighbors, and people on the street, never ask. What is man? What are we that God pays any attention to us? Or the Son of Man, that you actually come down and you visit him. You talk to him. You give him your word. You pay attention to him. You made him a little lower than spirit beings, spiritual beings. You crowned him with glory and honor. Now, what is glorious and what is honorable about a man? And did set him over the works of your hands. Well, the glory and the honor is that we are the superior being. The chickens and hogs and cattle and dogs and even whales and big elephants, like you go over to the circus and we saw recently on television, elephants being put through tricks that you could not believe. There's not a man in this room who could do a one-hand handstand on one arm. And I'll guarantee you there's not one man in here powerful enough to do a one-armed push-up. But when you see an elephant get up on two forelegs and then lift the other foreleg up, and that huge, big, ugly, ungainly, ponderous bulk standing there on one foreleg, it's just unbelievable. And yet they do it all the time in a circus. A great, huge elephant will stand on a big ball, just a ball, look very small, and just walk around on it. And finally on 2 feet, and finally on one, and just balance. And I've seen it done in a circus. Just unbelievable. A little diminutive little old girl, probably in tights over there with a little stick, saying something in Indian or something. And the elephant hears, sees, understands, and then does what the little girl tells the elephant to do. Not only great creatures, but electricity, magnetic forces, the inertial forces that have to do with a wheel within a wheel, which is a gyroscopic mechanism that man has been able to produce, which senses the motion of in any direction, left, right, up, or down, far more accurately than our inner ear and the fluid in it can ever sense. And so that men have been able now to actually guide themselves to the moon. They've been able to guide themselves in the darkest nights with an error of only maybe a quarter of a mile over thousands and thousands of miles. You have put all things in subjection under his feet, for in that he put all, every creature, and practically all the forces and energies of our earth under him, he left nothing that is not put under him. Whatever man sees, man dreams, envisions, man plans, and then man designs, and eventually man creates and produces. And you know, to show you, just a little example thinking when we were coming back, we don't really doubt the tremendous capacity of humankind for doing seemingly the impossible. If you look at offshore drilling and study how it is done, if you look at the Alaskan pipeline and pipelines across all the Middle East, if you were to go down here and visit your natural gas company and just look at the wall map, it would blow your mind. If you were to look at a national map of all of the natural gas pipelines in the United States, you would be looking at a crazy quilt spider's web that covers the entire country, and in many areas it's just dense, and it's especially dense in East Texas, where years and years ago they used to burn off billions of dollars worth of natural gas, which comes out first before they get the oil, but now, of course, they're trying to tap it, and we burn it. And so we're coming along the mountain range up there. We look over to the right, and I mean, this is one of the most precipitous gorges, and we're on these huge switchbacks, and we're way high, and the truck is just barely going at about 9.5 or 10.5, wherever we were. We looked over there, and there's a great, huge pipeline. And Larry commented, we're looking, and it looked like it was some trees. It looked like it dove right inside this mountain. And here's this huge monolithic bunch of granite that extends for miles, just a gargantuan mountain peak. And for the first moment, Larry said, the thing goes right through the mountain. Well, we looked up a little further, and no, it had taken a turn, and it went on up and over. And here was a pipeline that went from thousands of feet up, no doubt taking water probably down to Durango, I suspect. It looked like a water pipeline. It probably had to be so. And maybe 50, 60, 80 miles long. It was some of the most forbidding terrain that you've ever seen in the world. And man has been able to do that. How did they lay the first transatlantic, first oceanic cable? Do you know? Well, it just makes sense that if they had a cable on the shore, and they just went out with a huge big reel, a huge great big drum on the back end of a ship and just kept going, that the further they go, the weight of the thing is finally going to lay it along the bottom. And that's what they did on ships, like huge big ocean-going barges. And the weight of the cable, and it's protected, of course, by several different layers of very heavy materials and metals and all wound in there, and thousands or hundreds of wires all in a cable form inside this protective hull. Now there are many of them, but now we have the method of satellites, which are sort of going along the same as the world is in an Earth orbit rather than an orbit around the world, and they're kind of parked in that sense, although they are turning just as we turn, so that directly, line of sight, these big towers you see out there with the huge dishes in them are oftentimes is not only a microwave station that sends or relays television, which travels in line of sight like FM rather than bouncing off the ionosphere like AM radio does. It might be one of these units that will allow direct dial telephone calls to Europe or anywhere around the world just by bouncing them off those satellites. Unbelievable that man can be able to do that, but they have done it. So we see nothing that is not put under him. Now, when you think of nuclear energy, there's a great secret to that, and yet the secret to nuclear energy is no more difficult to uncover than the secret of water. Now, all of you know what water is. Some of you school kids here, you know what. What's the chemical designation for water? It's one of the simplest ones. H. Anybody know? You said oxygen, right? How do you spell water chemically? H2O, right, H2O. What's the H stand for? Hydrogen. What's the two? Two atoms, right? We're dealing with a molecule. Two atoms. Two atoms of hydrogen to one atom of oxygen. So H2, little small two, meaning two in parenthesis, O. Okay, two hydrogen atoms, one oxygen atom. Now, oxygen is everywhere around us. It's here in a room, even in a closet you get locked in, because 20% of the mantle of gas that is contained on the earth by gravity, like an envelope, but is pulled down and kept on the earth because it is heavier than the weightlessness of space. Air, made of all the gases and even the rarefied gases and so on, occupies space and has weight. It is containable in shapes, but it has no shape of and by itself. Now, you take two atoms of this air, this gas out here, and one atom of oxygen, two hydrogen, one of oxygen. Put them together, and you've got water. Now, you can separate them out by processes that are beyond my understanding. But when you take a hydrogen and oxygen and you mix it thoroughly, and then you strike a match, or you put an electrical spark to it, like lightning, or just knock two pieces of metal together, it explodes. And when it explodes, what do you get? Water. It explodes, and you get water. An explosion of two hydrogen atoms to one oxygen atom will bring about water. How many of you remember one of the greatest examples of that, unfortunately? Not a chemical experiment, but a very unfortunate experiment in 1937 in Lakehurst, New Jersey. The huge Hindenburg, the last of some of the most luxurious, if you study that, incredible methods of oceanic travel that has ever been devised by man. Here was a great, giant, cylindrical metal beast, of which there were many. Germans were the foremost in making them, but the United States also had them, and other countries did. Where people, like first-class passengers, would travel in a huge gondola, much, much bigger than this room, with huge suites and compartments, with beds and great dining rooms, and with liveried stewards, and with foot servants, high over the Atlantic Ocean, cruising along very slowly, maybe at 120 miles an hour, maybe 80 miles an hour, whatever, all the way across for days across the Atlantic Ocean in the huge airships that they called dirigibles. Well, when it was anchoring, unfortunately, the hydrogen was escaping and mixing with oxygen, and a metallic spark was struck. And it just burnt, whoosh. And if you've seen that famous picture, it appears that molten something or other is falling down to the ground. No, that was water. That explosion killed a lot of people. And, of course, the explosion continued in a very rapidly burning pyre that was the funeral pyre of many men as this metal actually melted. But what was produced was a water storm, a rainstorm, as a result of the explosion of that hydrogen gas mixed with the oxygen when a spark was applied. Now, you know what a nuclear explosion is, basically. It is merely bombarding the atom itself and making the atom, which is like a little tiny universe of neutrons, protons, and electrons moving rapidly in electrical charge, and suddenly just stopping the whole process and causing it to explode. Actually, in every little drop of water, you have a similar process. Why, and what is the principle of isostasy and viscosity and of the tensile strength not only of metals but the resistance of liquids, which try the best they can to shudder down into the smallest possible space? So whenever you have water and you pour it on the ground, pour it in a cup, you pour it in any kind of a vessel, it tries immediately to get into the smallest space possible. And on the surface of that water, the little molecules are just moving very, very rapidly. But underneath the surface, they're moving much more slowly. As it heats, they move far more rapidly. And the method I'm talking about of escape, you can imagine every little drop of water with its total surface now subjected to air. So somehow those little molecules sense that. And that little drop of water falling through the air is trying to assume the smallest shape possible. Now, since there isn't anything interfering with it, there are no rough angles, no corners, and it's trying to assume the smallest space possible, what space will it assume? Well, a perfect orb. There's no other space it can assume because there's nothing interfering with it as it falls. So, as it falls, a water droplet falling unimpeded in the air will be perfectly round. When I say perfect, I mean perfect. More perfect than any ball bearing could ever be perfectly round. When we hunters go out and try to shoot birds, we hunt with what is called chilled shot. Well, what they do is they melt lead or copper or steel, and they drop it out of little openings. They just dribble it down. And as it's falling, because it is now molten, the exterior molecules are moving very, very rapidly to try to cause that to assume the smallest space possible, and so it becomes perfectly round. And as it becomes perfectly round, at that exact distance that they've measured, know exactly the distance to have the tower, it drops into ice-cold water, and instantly, as it hits the water, it is chilled and maintains rigidly the shape it was in when it struck the water. So it's perfectly round. So a little shot that we use to shoot pheasants or ducks is called chilled shot, and it's perfectly round. Now, what causes that? What is tensile strength? What is sectional density? What is viscosity? Why does the surface molecule move rapidly, trying to protect and prevent the escape of the internal molecules in a drop of water. Now, unfortunately, they can't protect and prevent the escape of all of them. Some of them are crowding, and they're trying to escape. And like people who leave a football stadium just before the game is over, the little molecules are escaping, although many are linking together and trying to prevent it. And that process is called evaporation. So little by little, it will evaporate. Isn't it fortunate, says the World Book Encyclopedia, the word fortunate is used, that water above or below 32 degrees Fahrenheit or 0 degrees centigrade will expand in both directions, and it makes absolutely no sense at all, because metal and almost everything else we know, including water and any other kind of liquid, expands when it is subjected to heat. But water, when it is chilled, will assume the smallest possible space at exactly 32 degrees, and below that, it will begin to expand. I think it will assume the identical space from 32 to 29.2 degrees, if I recall exactly, and below 29.2 degrees Fahrenheit, it will begin to expand. The World Book Encyclopedia says, this is most fortunate. And they don't give God the credit. They don't say, isn't it marvelous that God, in His wisdom, produced it that way? This gas, mixing two parts to one part, with which He made the universe, and they say the building block of the universe is the hydrogen atom, and that it is liquid, solid, and gas in our environment, that we swim in it, bathe in it, brush our teeth in it. It makes up 98% of our bodies and of all of our animals. It makes up a tremendous percentage of all living herbs and trees and everything out here around us. No life could exist without it. It exists in all of these forms. The molecules rush like mad when it's heated until finally it's back into its gaseous form. And they slow and slow and slow until below 32 degrees they come to a stop. And when they stop, they crystallize. And they form the most beautiful and symmetrical shapes. And we call that ice. And ice does not sink to the bottom, which it should if it followed what appears to be the laws that govern every other liquid except water. But it is less dense than the surrounding water, and so it floats. And if it didn't, no life could exist, because all the microorganisms and the fish every year in the winter would freeze, drop to the bottom, there would be no life, and we could not live. But science doesn't tell you why, doesn't tell you how, who made it that way, and who sustains it that way. Well, as we ponder the phenomena, let's turn to the book of the Psalms, and understand a little bit about what David said. In 104 of the Psalms, and there are so many of them where David was a naturalist, and I love to read some of these and try to read them fairly slowly, although I see I've got to hurry now. Bless the Lord, O my soul, O eternal my God. You are very great. You are clothed with honor and majesty, who cover yourself with light as with a garment, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain, who lays the beams of his chambers in the waters, who makes the clouds his chariot, who walks upon the wings of the wind. Very poetic language, language exalting God. Who makes his angels, spirits, his ministers, meaning his angels, not his preachers, his ministers, a flaming fire, who laid the foundations of the earth that it should not be removed forever. And this is to become the center of the universe from God's point of view, because God is coming down here to make it his heaven. You covered it with the deep, just like a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. Yeah, even back before Adam was created, twice, three times, maybe more times. I was fishing along a reservoir up there. I wish I could have brought them back to you. The most beautifully preserved ripple marks I have ever seen in solid rock. And I mean tons of them. And they were so symmetrical. And I mean, they were this high. Just beautiful ripple marks. How were they caused? Well, you can go along any seashore and you can see ripple marks as the tides form ripples in the sand. But these were formed by a receding current or a tide, and then a very soft deposition after it began to harden in that form, quickly, before it could erode, quickly, before the wind could blow it away, came along and deposited another level of mud atop it. It froze, and in the years gone by, the other softer material eroded and left these rocks, and there are just the most perfect little wavelets imprinted in hard rock. They were all over the shore where we were fishing up at Miramonte Reservoir the other day. Just fantastic when I think of how old those were. They predated Jesus Christ walking on this earth. They were there probably either at the time of Noah or the time of Adam. You covered it with the deep as a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. At thy rebuke they fled. At the voice of thy thunder they hasted away. They go up by the mountains. They go down by the valleys into the place which you have founded for them. Talking about the drainage basins of the great rivers and bays and estuaries. You have set a bound that they may not pass over. You can stand on the seashore and you can look out there, and beyond you is just thousands of miles of water and raging waves and tides, and yet you can stand at a certain line. You can say, you will not come any further. And if you're at high tide and there's not a storm involved, you're right. The ocean has a boundary and it will not pass over, that they turn not again to cover the earth. He sends the springs into the valleys which run among the hills. They give drink to every beast of the field. Wherever you hunt deer, you want to find water, especially in a dry desert country, unless they're in an area where they can eat some of the type of cacti that will give them liquid. And you learn the habits of creatures because you know they have to come to water. So you'll wait around a water hole for doves in the evening, for deer in the morning or the late evening. And all the creatures, especially in Africa and the state parks, if in the great national parks, you'll go to find a water hole. And where you find that water hole, you wait, and you'll see every type of animal that inhabits the plains, from lions to every type of gazelle. The wild asses quench their thirst. By them shall the fowls of the heaven have their habitation, which sing among the branches. He waters the hills from his chambers. The earth is satisfied with the fruit of thy works. He causes the grass to grow for the cattle and the herb for the service of man, that he may bring forth food out of the earth. And wine that makes glad the heart of man. Talking about different types of grapes. And oil to make his face to shine. And bread which strengthens man's heart. We drove through Deaf Smith County on the way back over here. Planes and huge tractors out there that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, with gang plows that must be half as wide as this room. And out there with a big plume of smoke and dust behind him, and he's out there plowing away. And of course, millions of cubic, I guess they would say metric in this case, don't they measure them, tons of wheat being grown by American farmers to make bread. And of course, to feed cattle and chickens. The trees of the eternal are full of sap. And finally, when they quit flowing, the days get shorter and they get cooler, then what happens to them is what happened to these leaves a while ago. And they turn brilliant red. Why do they turn that color? And yellow, and orange, and every kind of rust color. And then they fall to the ground. That's why it's called the fall, more correctly perhaps autumn. But the reason it's called the fall is because the leaves fall. And then through the winter they're dormant, and the sap does exactly opposite from the flow of any other fluid. It doesn't flow down, it flows up. And the reason it does is because of the evaporation. As the warmer climate hits the tops of the little buds, they begin to kind of evaporate. Well, evaporation causes a suction. When the little leaves appear, there's all of this flowing liquid or fluid that is called sap, like a life-giving substance. And in a preordained pattern in every tree that forms the new leaves, they have the little Venetian blinds I told you about underneath on the underside, the soft side, the fuzzy side. And the top oily or slick side is the side that takes in the sun's rays. And down beneath, they have little Venetian blinds that open and close all the time, depending upon the heat. And as they give off the evaporation of the fluids, they cause the flow of sap. And here come new leaves. And of course, the creatures all feed on the leaves. Verse 17, where the birds make their nests. And we got birds outside our house. We just delight in watching them. Every year, we had a mockingbird sometimes nest twice a year. And, you know, actually produce about two different clutches of little eggs and little baby birds. As for the stork, the fir trees are her house. The high hills are a refuge for the wild goats. Larry and I saw one of the most interesting things that I have ever seen on a hunting trip in my life. It was almost worth the trip up there just to see this. Right up above Ouray, you're going back and forth on what they call a $1 million highway. Now it's probably the $20 million highway. Because they claim that the very rocks that were crushed to put underneath the asphalt all contain gold in them to some small degree. Now it's $1 million a mile to build freeway. But when I talk about steep, it's just like you can look down the side of this podium here or the side of your chair and imagine you're looking down 1,500 feet. It is just breathtaking. When you're sitting on the wrong side of the truck and you look down, you're really watching how this guy is driving over there, because there is no guardrail and very little shoulder. And I mean, you're just like a mountain goat. Well, we came around a corner and it was kind of a falls there in an area where some rocks had been kind of shored up by some timbers, and there was what we thought was a deer. And a car was stopping right in front of it, and we got closer. We says, it looks like a little buck. Got closer still, we realized, of all things, a Rocky Mountain bighorn had come down, and we were right at the top. I mean, it was just on up massive glacial ice and snow up above us, and huge icicles just all over the rocks on the side of the road. And here, wandering along the road and licking up some of that water, was a Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep. I don't know if that's the first one I've ever... No, it's second or third. I saw one in Banff National Park one time. That's the first one in the United States proper I've ever laid eyes on in my life in the wild. I think it was for Larry, too. First time ever. Unbelievable. It was really, really quite exciting to see it. And in order to save its life, because other cars were coming along, I rolled down the window and bang on the side of the thing, said, go on, get out of here, hurry, you know. And the thing took off up the mountain and stopped and looked back, licking its chops and looking at me. Had horns that came out about, what, quarter curl, half curl? Not real big, but anyway, it was really exciting to see that. The high hills are a refuge for the wild goats. Now, up there, I'd die, but the goat's quite comfortable. He really loves it up there, the sheep. And the rocks for the conies. He appoints the moon for seasons. God did that. The sun knows his going down. You make darkness, and it's night, wherein all the beasts of the forest creep forth. If I could have waited and I could have seen, if I had the eyes of an owl, I'd have got a deer. Might have been illegal, but I would have got a deer. But I couldn't wait that long. Darkness came, and they were all does. No buck showed up. The young lions roar after their prey and seek their meat from God. The sun arises, they gather themselves together and lay them down in their dens. Man goes forth unto his work, to his labor until the evening. And in contemplating all of this, creatures and man, David says, O Eternal, how manifold, meaning how technical, how intricate, and how many, how numerous are thy works. Now, how does a mosquito function? And what happens to mosquitoes who never get to bite you and drink any of your blood? Do they all starve to death? You ever thought about that? What about you kids? What do mosquitoes eat? You know, they eat decaying vegetation. They'll actually go down and stick their big long proboscis into rotting pieces of wood and decaying vegetation and things like that. They don't have to have blood. If they did, they'd all die because they can't all find you, you know. But they do. Once in a while, one of them will. But now when you investigate a mosquito, you look at one real close. That is the most grotesque-looking proboscis you've ever seen on any kind of a creature under a microscope. It's absolutely unbelievable. But what about his digestive system? And how do they find each other? And what about the little males with that funny-looking feather-shaped antenna? They're incredible hearing. How they can hear one way over there and then run over and find the female. And how do they mate? And how do they lay eggs? And why do the eggs sink down and become larvae that wiggle along in a rain barrel you've seen as a kid? And then finally become and pop out of the top another mosquito. All you got to think is anything. Pick anything you want to. That leaf, a fly, a little bug you're about to step on, an earthworm, a tree, and then go look it up in an encyclopedia and study about it. And you will just be standing there with your mouth open, amazed at the way it all works. O Eternal, how manifold are thy works. In wisdom have you made them all. The earth is full of your riches. Now, when I was up there in the mountains, especially in an evening, and you're waiting for something to move, it is so still that you can hear your ears ring. You hear a kind of a high-pitched swishing noise. You ever been that alone and that totally alone in a mountain area? It's kind of like, you know, you don't really hear anything. That's molecules of air. That's molecules of air hitting your eardrums. You're actually hearing air. Unless, like me, you've got a permanent ringing in your ears from the many times that my wife has hit me up alongside the head. No. I'm kidding. A permanent ringing in my ears from the many times I stuck my head in the after compartment of the Falcon. I'm just kidding. But anyway, yeah, with the years of jet travel, I've developed something like that. Sometimes it sounds like crickets, and sometimes it sounds like the voice of somebody calling me, and it is. No, most of the time it's just molecules of air. But when you're up there and it is so still and so quiet, you think, I'm the only critter around. You look down at your feet, and there goes a couple of bugs. And over here's a spider, and up there's a bird circling around. And all these trees are out there. And everything is kind of pulsating and living and breathing. And you're in a life environment, in spite of the fact you think you're all alone. This great and wide sea, wherein are things creeping innumerable. When you think of all the sea bottom creatures, both small and great beasts, there go the ships. There's that leviathan, that monster, whom you've made to play therein, like a huge blue whale that is as big as a locomotive. These all wait upon thee, that you may give them their meat in due season. Isn't it crazy that the largest mammal known to history, bigger than a huge, big brontosaurus, is the great blue whale. And the great blue whale feeds on almost microscopic organisms. They have this huge brush-like, what's called baleen, in their mouth. And their throat is very small. And that baleen is only like a huge big sweep. And as they swim through There's certain areas that are very, very rich, and when a ship plows through them, as I've seen off on the way to Korea on my aircraft carrier, every time the big bow wave would go in, you'd make a swishing noise. I mean, it would just be like greenish white and like your watch dial multiplied a million times. And the reason? Because that ocean is just rich with krill, or what is called plankton. Little microorganisms that assume every conceivable shape you can imagine. One drop of water filled with plankton, and you'll see critters of every size and shape with 6 and 8 and 10 legs and every kind of truncated little branch, cubes, round, oblong, every shape imaginable, and they're all little living organisms that are inhabiting the ocean. Now, they migrate every day and every night. In the daytime, when the sunlight hits the water, they migrate downward. They go way down deep to get away from the sunlight. At nighttime, they come up, and the whales know that. And the whales go in the thermoclines of water, and they find them. They swim along with their mouths partially open, and they're just straining millions of gallons of seawater. And as they do, those little microorganisms hang up on the baleen, and they actually digest and eat this krill. Some portions of the oceans are rich, and some portions of the oceans are almost devoid of krill or of plankton. And those little plankton, by the way, help provide oxygen. Little diatoms, they're called diatoms or diatoms, little microorganisms, in the ocean produce a tremendous amount of oxygen for man to breathe. There go the ships, there's that leviathan, that huge blue whale, and other great creatures whom you've made to play therein. These wait all upon thee, that you may give them their meat in due season, that you give them that they gather. You open your hand, they're filled with good. You hide your face, they're troubled. You take away their breath, they die and return to their dust. You send forth your spirit, they're created, and you renew the face of the earth. The glory of the Eternal shall endure forever. The Eternal shall rejoice in His works. He looks on the earth and it trembles, that is, if He's angry and causes an earthquake or a volcanic eruption. He touches the hills and they smoke, and God could cause that to happen. I will sing unto the Eternal as long as I live. I will sing praise to my God while I have my being. And what caused Him to feel that way? Looking at nature, at creation. My meditation of Him shall be sweet. I will be glad in the Eternal. You know, you can say hunting, and I never have apologized for hunting. I never have apologized to people like the Schweitzers of the world who believe you should never step on an ant or a mosquito, because they're just ignorant of what God says in His Word. That these creatures were made for man. Now my Bible tells me, thou mayest eat of the hart and the roebuck. And I don't know any way to go down to the market and buy me a hart or a roebuck. The only way I'm going to do that is to get out into the woods where they are and to find them. So, when I get out and I hunt, my mind is not thinking only avariciously, oh, I hope I can get one. I'm not just devastated to disappointment with disappointment if I don't get an animal. Because I've shot my share, and I've got some beautiful trophies on the wall, but also ate the meat, brought the meat back and ate the meat and so on. And as I was telling my wife this morning, you know, my trophy hunting is virtually over. I've got an elk that no human being should ever expect to be able to get in his whole life. It's just a huge thing. A moose that is virtually a record type. A caribou that is in the same class. And some acceptable deer. And there's no reason at all to be disappointed, because I have such tremendous enjoyment of being out, being up there in those mountains, seeing the cattle around, seeing the herds of sheep coming down into the lower country, talking to the ranchers, living out there in the open among all those trees, seeing the seasons coming on, and just experiencing what it's like, looking at the smallest little lichens on a rock, at the little herbs, the trees, and the changing of their colors, and just realizing how God made it all, how it got shaped and how it got formed. I will sing unto the Eternal, verse 33, as long as I live, I will sing praise to my God while I have my being. My meditation of Him shall be sweet. I will be glad in the Eternal. Let the sinners be consumed out of the earth, and let the wicked be no more. Bless thou the Eternal, O my soul. Praise ye the Lord. I was going to give you Psalms 49. It's a beautiful psalm. And Psalm 37, expound that whole thing, and then complete with Psalm 71. I've only got one of them. You can read those others, and you can get a very, very good message out of Psalm 71, by the way, that certainly could apply to this church and to us at this time. And I certainly take comfort in that and ask that it apply to me. But let's turn back to Hebrews to close, right where we began in the second chapter. Verse 6, what is man that thou art mindful of him, or the son of man that you pay any attention to him? And you know, there is no time in the entirety of your life when you feel any smaller than when you're up in those magnificent mountains all by yourself. You get away by yourself, and all you see, and there were vistas up there where we could see at least 100 miles. I mean, there were mountain peaks over there that looked like 16 snow cones from 21 or 47 flavors or whatever it is over here. Just magnificent. Clear over into another state. It dawned bright and clear on that Sabbath morning after it had been snowing on Friday, and Friday afternoon when we put up our camp. And the next several days, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, it was flawless. There was not a cloud in the sky day after day. Beautiful, bright hues. You get up way before sunrise, so you saw every sunrise. And you're out hunting until full dark, so you see every sunset. And just magnificent. And there's never a time when you feel quite so insignificant and quite so small and tiny as when you're out in that vastness all by yourself. You don't hear a sound. And it's strange, you know, the things you don't miss. You don't miss television. You don't miss electricity. You don't even miss flushing toilets. It's kind of nice when you get back to them, but you realize you don't have to have those things. All you need are the simple things in life. And your simple observations and the little simple lessons that come into your mind are more profound, I think, at a time like that. If it takes hunting season to cause you to get out and do that, then by all means do it. But if all you want to do is just to camp, even if you camp at the feast, if you plan ahead, we've got a beautiful site we're going to be able to go to near Huntsville, at Guntersville State Park. Just a breathtaking site. And I think that they were looking at Branson, and we might come up with another breathtaking site right out in nature with hills and lakes and beautiful trees and areas to hike and to get out into nature. And I think it'll be so much nicer to all of us be together in one environment and to be out in the middle of nature rather than in a big city, back and forth from a motel to a big auditorium. And it's always been my idea that the best feast we ever had was really at Big Sandy or at Jekyll Island, a place where you're near nature, right on the sea coast or right out in the woods and so on. It's going to be much, much nicer to do that. But sometime during the year, even if you're not a hunter or if you can't get out and enjoy it in that way, you ought to get out and camp. Or you ought to at least go out to a park somewhere out here in the wilderness and get out into the outdoor environment and just contemplate it, look at it, ponder it. And then maybe just pick one particular tree and go look it up in an encyclopedia. Did you ever do that? Did you ever take an encyclopedia with you into the bathroom in the morning and just flip it open somewhere and get to look and then stop at an article and read it? Encyclopedias are fascinating. Got a lot of information in them. I was sitting there after breakfast this morning. I decided to look up the word water. You might have guessed that. So I read the article on water. It was fascinating. Just incredible. I only read a part of it. Didn't have time to read it all. It's a big article. A lot of information on water, the whole water cycle through the whole land, through our bodies and insects and how it works, it's all there. So why? You put all things in subjection under his feet, for in that he put all in subjection under him, he left nothing that was not put under him, but now we see not yet all things put under him, but we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels, just like we are. He would have breathed just as hard as I did going up the mountain the other day. He would have had to go out after breakfast with the same bodily processes, have to eat food and drink water, and his vision would have been just as limited, and his reach just as limited, and his physical body would require the same sustenance. He was human, a little lower than the angels, for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he, by the grace of God, should taste death for every man. And here is the lesson of the whole Bible, in a sense, in a few verses, in this little microcosm of the Bible, which Hebrews is. For it became him for whom are all things, and by or through whom, because he's the creator, are all things. Now, I got to stop there to tell you something else. It has always puzzled me. One time, I got to hurry. I had to take the opportunity to go skin diving, scuba diving, or snorkeling, rather. Scuba diving is deeper. At Eilat, in the Red Sea, in the Gulf of Aqaba. And when I got down there off this shelf, it was a big shelf, and it went down real deep. But on the shelf, right there in shallow water, maybe 8 to 15 feet or so deep, and down about 6 to 8 feet, I mean the most myriad forms of life. I can't begin to describe it. There were little fish that were literally red, white, and blue striped. They were yellow and red polka dotted. They were brilliant white and orange and every color of the rainbow. And I'll tell you that in those Mediterranean waters, in the Indian Ocean and so on, there are more exotic types of saltwater fish than there are in our comparatively more temperate and colder climates especially on the Oregon coast, I can guarantee you that. It was just like a riot. And apparently, the deeper you go, the more exotic. There are fish down there that actually have antennae that glow, that have lights. There are angler fish hundreds and thousands of feet deep, thousands of feet down, way deep. There is actually one fish, you can look it up, that has teeth about that long. Its head is about this big, tapers down to a little bitty body, and just looks like a giant head filled with teeth. I've seen pictures of those, and they've actually brought them up in some of these bathyspheres. And you think, God made those, but why are they either grotesque or elaborate, or why do these anglerfish do what they do? Can you imagine a fish, a huge fish? It looks like a huge rock with a lot of moss growing on it. It has no shape at all. And it spins, its pectorals look almost like arms with little fins on it, but stuff growing out of it all over that's actually material, tissue, part of the fish's skin, but it looks just like foliage. It looks like seaweed. And it's real hard to spot where the eye is because it radiates out in all kinds of colors. And here right in the top of its head is a funny-looking big long wand, and it's folded up along its back. Well, it puts the wand forward, and there's a little meaty thing out there, and it goes do-do-do-do-do, dangles it around. Little fish swims along. What's that? Looks like a fisherman with a worm on a pole, dangling it. Little fish runs over to take a look. I mean, so fast, the action sucks water in, expels it out of the gills, creates a current, and it's so rapid that your eye cannot see it, because we had them in our own aquarium at Ambassador College when we took those pictures, and it defied you. You know, poor goldfish, but we had to feed them goldfish. We put goldfish in and say, now watch this and see if you can catch it. And that thing would dangle the worm, and the goldfish would swim up and take a look. You know, about like that, and all of a sudden, whomp! I mean, it was invisible to your eye, and that angler had swallowed that goldfish. And I've often pondered, why? You know, only God, I guess, can enjoy some of those things, because until this age, no man ever saw some of those creatures. Do you know that? Until the age of guys like Jacques Cousteau and bathyscapes, bathyspheres, or whatever, and so on. Until this age, nobody ever even got to enjoy what some of those creatures are. By whom are all things, and for whom are all things, in bringing many sons unto glory, to make the author or the captain of their salvation perfect through sufferings. Well, that's the purpose. We're to become members of the very creating family of God. And when I ponder, as I look at anything from the symbiotic relationship of elk to aspen, and any of you hunters know what that is, very few people know that, but in the winter, when it really gets tough going, not only do the elk huddle in the aspen groves where they're very, very thick and under the black timber for shelter, but they eat the bark of the tree. And the bark of the tree has quinine and very, very rich minerals in it. It's very good for the elk, and they stay warm and healthy through the winter that way. Otherwise, they would completely starve to death. Sometimes the winter's so bad that they will starve to death. But as I'm out there and I look and I ponder, I'm trying to think of each thing, whether it's a single aspen tree, and of the symmetry and the beauty of it and how it lives and the type of structure of the wood. And I think as I read in the Psalms, read of what God said to Job, read of what the Apostle Paul said in Romans, the first chapter, that we know and appreciate things about God by looking at things He made. So become appreciative of nature. You can actually worship God by looking at the things that His hands have made.